Greetings, everyone. Mark Suddeth, HurricaneTrack.com, here with another chapter of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. Thank you for joining me. It is January 22nd, 2020, and in this chapter, we will examine the year 2000. A new century, a new decade began. Now, several years after I began my career, I had been through five hurricanes now at this point, and that would be Bertha, Fran, Bonnie, Dennis, and Floyd. I had my hurricane maps business well underway. Storm surge maps were out. I won the award from FEMA at the end of 1999. You would think that, you know, had I been a publicly traded company, one of those startups, and hey, you know, 1999, 2000, that was the heyday of the dot-coms. Remember? I do. I had a dot-com. I was Hurricane99.com. in 1999, and that transitioned over to HurricaneTrack.com in the year 2000. But had I been one of those publicly traded, you know, dot-com boom companies, I would have been doing very, very well, probably been a billionaire you know, back in the day. That's how well things were going in my career, and it's true, and it's pretty remarkable. I look back, and I think about it, and I talk about it on this series. And you're privy to all of that, you know, like we've said many times, or I've said, there's no we. Well, there was the other night when it was myself and Mike Farrow, but this is very much like a book on tape, if you think about it. And it's just a good way to reminisce about the past. And now we're up to the year 2000. So we all survived the Y2K. I don't want to call it nonsense, but there was no major meltdowns of nuclear power plants. The grid didn't shut off. It wasn't like the Matrix where everything just went to the toilet. We got through it. So here we are in the year 2000, and I began to look ahead. You know, what was going to be next as I forged ahead in my career, both in the hurricane awareness business as well as in the hurricane intercepting business and the dot-com there with HurricaneTrack.com. What would happen with all of that? So we begin the year 2000 right where I left off and from 1999 and the previous years there, building everything up. And one of the big things that I wanted to do, as you recall, I talked about that I had this Isuzu Rodeo that I had purchased in 1999. That was purchased in July 99. I used it in Hurricanes Dennis and Floyd. I talked about how that was on CNN, and that amazing time there spent with Jeff Flock on CNN, with the Davis weather station up on top of the Isuzu, collecting wind data. It was really neat, but I wanted to make it better. And I had some funding. I sold some of these posters, the Hurricane Coast poster, early days of crowdfunding. And I sold enough so that I had enough money to buy a new anemometer. An anemometer is a wind gauge. And that would be a big change for me, something that I really was wanting to do a much better job of, and that was collecting data. I was a geek, a weather geek, and I really wanted that wind data. So I talked about in the year 1999, going to the National Hurricane Conference for the first time, spending some time learning from the forecasters there, the scientists there. One of them was Stacy Stewart, Forecaster Stewart, as we call him. And he gave me advice on how to collect wind data. And I took that to heart. So in the year 2000, I had enough funds to purchase one of these high-end scientific equivalent pieces of equipment. You have hobby equipment, prosumer equipment, and then you have truly scientific level, science grade, top-notch, very expensive equipment. You have that in astronomy, photography, medical field, etc. And the same certainly holds true in the world of meteorology. And that company is R.M. Young, the R.M. Young company out of Traverse City, Michigan. And they make these precision pieces of equipment for temperature, pressure, wind readings, environmental readings, etc. And I got my hands on this R.M. Young propeller-based anemometer. It's about $1,500 for one unit. I think it's still roughly that even today. And they are remarkable. They use these anemometers on the hurricane buoys out in the Caribbean and the Atlantic, the Gulf of Mexico, elsewhere. They're used in tornado research and in extreme environmental measurement conditions, extreme cold, extreme wind, high durability. I mean, you don't go to the mall, or as it stands now, I guess the airport where Brookstone is. I'm picking on Brookstone, but you don't go buy these at the airport while you're waiting to catch your next flight and bring it home to your kid as a gift. These are precision instruments. And I wanted one, and I got one, and I got the tracker that goes with it. It's called the wind tracker, and that gives you the readout. These things are all electrical-based, using tiny electric impulses that are generated by the turning of the propeller, and that sends a small impulse, and it gets translated through the weather tracker, the wind tracker, into a readout, you know, that tells us miles per hour, or knots, or whatever the case may be. You can set that on this little gadget that you would mount wherever. Some people mount them on their yachts. People put them in maybe like a marina. So you have like the harbor master's quarters. Maybe there's an anemometer and a wind tracker there. Weather service offices maybe use them. I think they use a different style, but it's a high-end piece of equipment, and I was very stoked to get it. So that's exactly what I did. I bought one, and I mounted it up on the Isuzu and put the wind tracker inside the Isuzu up on the dashboard and had everything hardwired. And voila, with the flip of a switch, I would have live wind readings from a true high-end weather station, at least for wind. And I was very, very excited about that. And I got that pretty early in 2000. Also that year, went to the National Hurricane Conference again, and this time I believe it was down in New Orleans, and I was very excited to be there, moving up in the world. I took my Macintosh with me, my PowerMac G3, and showed off a lot of the storm surge project stuff that I was doing. I also got to visit that year the Mississippi Gulf Coast for the first time. The Hurricane Highway went through Mississippi for the first time ever for me, and I was very excited about that, to see these places that I read about from past hurricanes. Betsy, 1965, Camille, 1969, and visit these areas. Gulfport, Biloxi, Pass Christian, Bay St. Louis, all these legendary places in the world of hurricane lore. You know, they're real. They really are. But when you are a diehard weather geek like me, and you visit a place like the coast of Mississippi or Galveston, Texas, I would get there in 2001, it really is like visiting the home of Elvis, you know, where you go to Memphis or whatever, and or you go to England and you visit Abbey Road and you see where the Beatles were or whatever. I mean, for hurricane aficionados, hurricane geeks like me, visiting the Mississippi coast was a big deal, and I got to do that in 2000. And again, I attended the conference, the Hurricane Conference in New Orleans. I actually had a booth. I had enough funding from my mapping business, my storm surge map project, etc., my tracking maps and so forth, that I was able to afford a booth in the exhibit hall. And I was right in there with all the other vendors. And I got to meet Lou Fincher. That year, Lou Fincher is in the Friendswood area of Texas. Basically, you could just say Houston. Houston's a big area, but you get down towards Galveston, you have these other cities. Friendswood is where Lou Fincher is. He had a company, maybe he and his wife still operate it now. It's called Hurricane Consulting, Inc. And he did a lot of hurricane preparedness consulting work back from his days in safety management, etc., at DuPont. So I got to meet Lou, and Lou is one of these guys that like knows everybody. You know, he knew Max, he knew all the guys at the Hurricane Center, he knew people at the Weather Service, and Lou was one of these people that he could drop names on you and it just blew your mind. So I got to meet him that year and interact with other people that I'd heard about all my career, you know, different people from FEMA, different people from the Weather Service. And because I had won the award from FEMA in 1999, my name was out there a little bit more. I got to meet more people, and it was just great. So I forged ahead after the conference, you know, looked ahead to the season. What would the year 2000 hurricane season be like on the heels of five hurricanes in a row? Well, roughly in a row for North Carolina, Bertha Fran, Bonnie Dennis Floyd. Anyway, there was hurricanes elsewhere in the country. Of course, they weren't all just in North Carolina. But I had only intercepted or chased, whatever you want to call it, hurricanes in North Carolina up to this point. And why not? They all came to me. So I was kind of ready to branch out. And I was still working with Eddie Smith in New Hanover County. The Project Impact program was still going, though it was going to wind down. There was seed money that FEMA gave, and you know, these projects get up and running, and then you kind of let it stand on its own two legs and develop and maybe grow into its own thing to build these disaster-resistant communities. But I was still very much a part of that, very active with Project Impact. Mike Farrow, my guest from the last episode, from part three there of 1999, I worked with him, the Cumulus stations in Wilmington. I mean, I was very active. My name finally was really getting out there, to the extent that I even picked up some more projects. I had interest now from the state of Georgia in the three coastal counties. North Carolina has 21 coastal counties, 21 or 22, something like that. Georgia has three, and the three coastal counties down there, they were all involved in Project Impact now. Savannah, Brunswick, I mean, Project Impact was growing across the country. It was expanding up into Freeport, New York, East Rockaway, New York. I had interest from them to do hurricane awareness projects, storm surge related, especially in the Northeast, in Georgia. And so these projects all began to take root. You know, everything takes time, especially when you're dealing with the government. Even if it's a public-private partnership, you don't just do something. Trust me, if you ever did anything with the government, you know, it probably takes even longer now. But these are where all of these projects began to take root. My name got out there more and more, and it was a very exciting time for sure. So we get into the season of 2000, and HurricaneTrack.com, you know, doing its thing, you know, what we call blogging now. We talked about this already. And I shed, of course, the name Hurricane99.com was no longer relevant in the year 2000. And I just brought in, I had already purchased HurricaneTrack.com, and that became the dominant, you know, staple site. That's what it was called, is HurricaneTrack.com. And it really began to gain more traction. News articles were done about it. You know, it was the portal, the face of everything that I represented. And it was a real exciting time, for sure, being one of the only people that was doing this at the time. There was myself. There was Jim Williams, who ran HurricaneCity.com and down in Delray Beach area, Southeast Florida. And, you know, the GoPBI site, storm2000.com or something. There was a handful, not like now, where everybody has a Facebook page, everybody's a weather expert, and there's a lot of noise. It's a different world today, that is for sure. But back then, it was the heyday. It was really in the early part of my career still, you know, just riding that wave, literally, advancing the science of, you know, data collection. I was very into that, like I mentioned. Also continuing to work on different ways to get hurricane awareness out to more people in innovative ways. I began doing animations, computer simulation and CGI animations at the request of Max Mayfield at the National Hurricane Center at the time. I was able to take pictures. I've talked about this before. I know I did. I'll refresh your memory, and mine too. I was able to take photographs, real photographs of an area. I worked with the Army Corps of Engineers to do this, and this is part of why I won the award that I did in 1999. Part of the success of the storm surge maps was because we could take actual photographs of buildings and put digital water on those photographs, a CG, computer-generated imagery, CGI, bring the photograph into a three-dimensional world and add stuff to it, clouds, water that would reflect buildings from the photograph. It was pretty freaking awesome. Now, you can do all that with your iPhone and have augmented reality and turn yourself into a cat or a donkey or, I mean, with the Snapchat filters and everything else, it makes what I did in 1999 and 2000 look like, you know, and I guess that's where they came up with the okay boomer, but I'm not a baby boomer. That would be my parents. I think it sometimes is misguided and mislabeled how people use that term, but I digress. What we can do now on an iPhone is incredible, isn't it? But back in the day, 99, 2000, at the turn of the century, as they say, well, that's a way to put it. It really was remarkable what I was able to do. And to take that vision of what we saw in the movies, right? You know, I learned a lot by watching people like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and James Cameron and others that did stuff in movies that were groundbreaking. And that had a big influence on me, watching computer-generated imagery evolve. And then being able to use a prosumer, one level down from Industrial Light and Magic grade stuff to do what I wanted to do in the world of hurricane awareness. And I brought that to Max, and he got very excited about it. And we worked with the Corps of Engineers very closely and developed this really neat animation showing storm surge rising, simulating what a Category 3 or 4 would do at the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel in New York. I did this. This was amazing. It was on NBC News. It was on the National Hurricane Center website. It's probably still out there somewhere. And I took this photograph of the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel that the Corps of Engineers provided to me. We all worked together to understand how high the water would potentially get in like a Category 3 hurricane, maybe a 4. I think it was a 3, though. It's going to be real hard to get a 4 up into New York, obviously. So you want to be realistic and not create too much hype. So I think we capped it at 3, estimated on the photograph how high stuff was. There's 10 feet, there's 15 feet or whatever. And I got my what are called markers, right? I was able to understand how to animate the water. First, the rise of water, but then also to make it flow so that it looked like it was going into the tunnel. We were right at the entrance of the tunnel where the photograph was taken, and I'm telling you, it worked. And I was even able to put like tires and sticks and debris in the water and make it flow, and you had that perception that it was going from, you know, where you were as the point of view of the camera in the water towards the tunnel. The debris would get smaller as it disappeared into the tunnel. I did all of that on a Power Mac G3 in my office, you know, here in Southeast North Carolina. And it was remarkable to see that come to life and what that led to. You know, like I said, they used it on like NBC Nightly News for a story. I can't remember exactly when. There was so much going on back then that I didn't keep up with everything. I mean, it was like, okay, my work's good. People are picking up on it. This is what I would expect to happen. I didn't archive a lot of news stories. I probably should have, but I didn't. I just kind of enjoyed it and was happy with the results and moved on, you know, and used that success to build other projects. So that was a big part of the year 2000. And again, what an age, the dot-com era, big time, you know, everything was a dot-com, right? And the world of computers was exploding, the internet. The online bubble was just growing exponentially every month. Computers became faster, better. You know, everybody had a cell phone now, even if it was an old big one, a brick almost, or a bar phone or a flip phone or whatever. You know, they were becoming almost ubiquitous to where everybody literally had one, you know, and that would all set the stage for what was to come. Of course, we know that now. So the hurricane season got here, and it was kind of lackluster overall. a fairly busy season, but no hurricane landfalls that year, believe it or not. Can you remember back? Now coming up on 21 years ago. Holy cow. Yes, the year 2000, we had no hurricanes make landfall in the U.S. that year. Came very close, and there was a, there's always these pivotal moments, right? And the big one for 2000, I think, if I had to put my finger on, what was the most, the benchmark moment of 2000? It had the awareness work that I talked about and these animations I was working on, etc. But in the world of field missions, Eddie Smith, the guy that I worked with at New Hanover County Department of Emergency Management, he was an intern there, remember? He and I set out late in the evening in mid-September for Hurricane Gordon. It was a Gulf hurricane heading into the Big Bend area, maybe Cedar Key. And, I waffled on whether or not I should go. And the Isuzu was ready. It had the anemometer on there, the Arm Young, the wind tracker. And, our site was doing great, hurricanetrack.com. Remember, we had these interactive tracking maps where you'd mouse over the different points on the map or regions on the map. You could mouse over, we had a little icon of the Isuzu even that my buddy Jason, my good friend Jason, my grade school lifelong best friend, he programmed all of that. I mean, we were way ahead of, what we have now with Google Maps and the ability to mouse over things and have pop-up information. We were doing that in the year 2000, and it was remarkable. But it all had to be done manually. That was the only problem. When advisories came out, we didn't have any scripts that we have now. Probably could have back then, but I was just glad to have maps. So I'd have to update things manually. It was a small text line file I would update, and boom, it was done. But that included data coming from the truck, or the SUV, the Isuzu. And so I have this little line of code that when I get a wind reading or a pressure reading, I could upload that line of code. And if you moused over the Isuzu on the map, you'd see where we are. I'd upload my GPS from like a Garmin handheld GPS device or something. All of that would update on the map, but I had to do it. And if I couldn't do it, and remember, we did not have wireless internet yet. That was still a year away. So I'd have to stop at a gas station and plug the laptop. I finally bought a laptop, by the way. I know I talked about that in 99, where I borrowed one from UNC Wilmington for Dennis and probably Floyd too. But in 2000, I finally bought a laptop. And yeah, I'd have to plug it in, with a phone cord and connect at 28.8 or 56K or whatever, and upload stuff to the site. And so it was, few and far between these updates, but they were updates nevertheless, and little mini blogs, quick tidbits. Now, hey, we call that Twitter. Yeah, we were doing that 21 years ago. So Eddie and I head down there, and we go out to Cedar Key, and it's like a hurricane chaser convention. I was there with the Isuzu, and I had another piece of equipment with me that little did I know would become a defining moment in the world of intercepting hurricanes, not just for me, but for pretty much everybody else. And that was the fact that I had taken my Hi8 camcorder. It was just a Sony Handycam Hi8. It might have been Digital 8 at this point. I think it actually was what they call Digital 8. It's still Hi8, but it's a little bit better quality, called Digital 8. And it's still recording sequentially on tape, in case you didn't know that. Like a chip and your cell phone or whatever, that's all kind of random access memory. It's non-sequential. It's non-linear. Whereas tape, audio cassettes, reel-to-reel, videotape, is generally thought of as linear or sequential. Even if it's digital information, you still have to go back and forth on the tape to get to it. You can't just randomly access it instantly like you can with computer chips these days, SD cards and so forth. Nevertheless, whatever it was I had, Sony Handycam, I had purchased, I don't even know. Was eBay around? I can't remember how I found this. But I had located like a $2,500 scuba diving housing minus the electronics inside of it that normally you would take a video camera or a digital camera, one of the early digital cameras of the day, and you'd plug it in and you can control it from the handheld controllers of this. Let's put it this way. It would be what filmmakers that wanted to film something underwater would use. So we're talking, it was literally like a $2,500 piece of equipment, but the electronics were not in it. It was like the shell, whatever they make that out of. I can't remember what it's made out of. It's not carbon fiber, but it was like this, it's the scuba diving housing, but it didn't have the electronics. That's the point here. So it only cost me, I think that it was like $800, which is still a lot, but I had the funding. So I bought it. And you put your camera on it. It has a little thread screw on the bottom, and it slides in this little track. And you slide the video camera all the way to the front so that the lens is pressed up against the glass. And it was very heavy. And there's no controlling it. You just turn it on, put it in, seal it up, and you can film in the rain. That was the idea. I didn't want to go scuba diving with it. I'm not out there filming manatees and, you know, fish. I wanted to film outside of the Isuzu without getting the camera wet. So that's what I did. And boy, I nailed it. I really did. It was incredible. Got this amazing point of view footage. And Eddie was there with me. It was remarkable. The waves were crashing up against the bulkhead of where this bridge was at Cedar Key. Cedar Key, right? I mean, 16 years later, what would we do at Cedar Key? Remember? Hermine? Yeah, we'll get there. That'll be in a much farther down the road episode or chapter. But that's where it started, was Cedar Key. I had this housing, filming the effects from Gordon, which weakened down to a tropical storm right before landfall at 70 miles per hour. I was keeping up with the wind readings, the pressure readings, noting those. Literally, we had no data out there. We didn't, you know, duck into somebody's condo or restaurant. Hey, can I use your phone line and plug in my computer? So what I did, I would literally call my wife back home in North Carolina and ask her, can you update these lines of code for me? I taught her how to do it, and she did it. And voila, the website would update. It was like maybe twice an hour. But in the year 2000, that was pretty remarkable to get these updates, right? You know, and just a quick comment, you know, can you just put this on the site, please? And she would. And it was awesome. It really was. And so there I was filming in the elements. You know, waves were crashing over me. I was wearing like a yellow rain jacket kind of thing. And I had the letters HIRT embroidered on the back of it, like, you know, like an FBI jacket or something, or where it says police, you know. This said HIRT for Hurricane Intercept Research Team. And I wore that with some rain pants and filmed it, you know, right at point blank. I would put the camera housing right on the railing and film the waves. And there was several somebodies actually, but one of the somebodies that we all know today, at least we should if we follow this stuff closely, and it was Jim Eds, J-I-M-E-D-D-S, Jim Eds. He was there, and also Jim Leonard, also Mike Tice, and others that I've come to know over the years. Like I said, it was this big convention. We all knew that Cedar Key was going to take the brunt. So everybody just kind of showed up, and totally by random and by accident, you know, wasn't planned, but we were all there, and we stayed out there, Eddie and myself, until probably 8:30, 9 o'clock that night. Gordon made landfall nearby. We got some good wind readings, some pressure readings, emailed those when we could to the National Hurricane Center, collected great video, that is for darn sure, from both the camera housing as well as, you know, filming from inside the Isuzu, et cetera. A lot of before establishment shots, you know, good B-roll kind of stuff. And it was great. You know, we were exhausted, but it was a really good intercept, considering that the year 2000 was generally lackluster. You know, I think there was 15 named storms that year, 15 or 16. So it was a busy season, but the hurricanes just managed to avoid the United States. That was the big deal. And, you know, we needed it after the five that we had in the late 90s. And that was pretty much it. So, you know, this is will end up being a fairly short chapter. But some of the years are like that. You know, you get these breakthrough moments that will lead to other things. And, you know, again, to kind of rehash that, the two that really stand out from the year 2000 would be the computer animation that I was working on, these continuation of these projects with these project impact communities that were growing more and more, numerous around the country, as I mentioned, Georgia, and these two villages, as they're called, the village of East Rockaway and the village of Freeport in New York, that would all come in into play a year later. But there was something else that happened in 2000 that, again, set the stage and was getting ready to open a very big door for me. Part of the Project Impact program in New Hanover County and in Wilmington was that we'd have this massive Hurricane Awareness Expo at the Trask Coliseum at UNC Wilmington, where they play men's basketball. You can fit 6,000 people in there. And 1999 and 2000, we had these just huge events. All of the media worked together. ABC, NBC, Fox, all the stations, whether it was Cumulus or another group of stations, Beasley Broadcasting or whomever, I think that was one of them, you know, all the stations, everybody would get together. We all worked together. Lowe's, Home Depot, you know, Car Drug, CVS, or whoever, Walgreens. Well, we didn't have Walgreens yet, but you get what I mean? If it was politics, you would say we put our partisan lines aside, the party lines, you know, merged, and we did. We all worked together, and we would have thousands and thousands of people that would come to this expo and learn about hurricanes. They would hear from the Weather Service. They would hear from, you know, vendors, people from Lowe's, Home Depot, about generators. They would, the private companies, about window protection. You know, me, I had a booth, and I would give out maps and talk about what I did in hurricanes. And little did I know that, well, let me back up a minute. Lowe's and Home Depot were kind of some of the marquee sponsors, Lowe's Home Improvement. And so Lowe's corporate sent a representative to the 2000 Expo, and he picked up some of the stuff from around the different vendors, the booths, etc., and he mingled with me, and we're going to talk about this guy a little bit in the next episode, next week, that was a, you know, just, if you know my history, you know what's coming, and that was the seed for it, that Hurricane Expo in the year 2000, another real big one, and the fact that Lowe's had sent one of their community relations people down there from Community Relations Corporate was big. And I'll tease that as that goes into the year 2001. So that was a big stepping stone, that huge Hurricane Expo, a lot of fun. The data that was collected, you know, my interactions with the Hurricane Center to send that information in. I actually worked on like my own little documentary type thing, put one together about Hurricane Gordon that year. I used some music from, you know, copyrighted sources back then. I wasn't able to digitally record music like I can now, where I score my own stuff. I think I used some stuff from Hans Zimmer that year, and why not? You know, he's one of the best. And his music goes real well with some hurricane footage, as you can imagine. And yeah, it was great to work with Eddie continuously and expand that relationship with him in not only intercepting hurricanes, but what do we do with that data? You know, how do we use it to help the community? And what do we learn from it? Showing examples of the effects, you know, not just out there recording for the heck of recording. You know, we weren't just thrill seekers. And that really started to show. It really did. And I translated that well through the website, writing up reports about what we did out there, the data that was collected, and the impacts and so forth. And so the year wrapped up the year 2000 wrapped up again on a very positive note. You know, it was myself, in terms of my personal life, myself, my wife, and two kids. And but that would change again in 2001, of course. You know, I've got seven kids now, right? So there's the end. I gave away the end. If you didn't know that and you pick yourself up off the floor, yes, I do. I have seven kids. So if you're keeping track, in the year 2000, I was up to two. So we have five more to go throughout the course of finishing this podcast series over the next couple of years. That'll be something, won't it? So that's it. I mean, you know, the year 2000, best summed up as keeping the momentum going. All these exciting projects just gained more traction. And I was very proud, very honored to be able to do this and do it for a living. You know, I was able to support my family and do this full time. You know, it's not 8 to 5. I go and punch a time card and, you know, at 8 and clock out at 5. I worked at home. And so I did what I could. I was able to still be a family man. Never had to put my kids in daycare, so forth and so on. They were getting ready. Nathan was getting ready to start school. You know, he was old enough now. He was born in 97. That wouldn't be too long that he'd be starting school, right? So things are progressing. You know, my career is doing great. Personal life, growing the family, able to do this full time. And, you know, what a road ahead. The old hurricane highway metaphor, definitely in full force here, that it finally led out of North Carolina, you know, down to Cedar Key, Florida, I-95, down to, you know, probably 75 to Gainesville, and then from there out 24, Highway 24 it is, out to Cedar Key. So the hurricane highway, you know, leaving the state of North Carolina for the first time in the year 2000. All of that, you know, so there you go. In the next chapter, as we get into the year 2001, obviously a very, very big and important year for our country. You know why? September 11th, and all of that had a big impact on what I was doing as well. And then, you know, as I tease ahead for what we'll go over next week, probably going to break 2001 up into two separate parts, part one and part two. So next Wednesday night, I'll drop part one and we'll go over some things that were growing in the year 2001, more projects coming online, storm surge mapping, etc. That's also the year that I met one of our very important colleagues, Jesse Bass. Yeah, he came in into the scene in 2001 officially, even though I had met him previously, probably at one of those expos, I think he said. But I'm getting ahead of myself. That's next week. So more exciting things to come up as we go into the first full year after the new decade and the new millennium, etc., the new century. The year 2000 behind us, we will get into the year 2001 in next week's episode, or chapter, as it were, of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. As always, I cannot tell you, I mean, I never will be able to emote through this podcast. I mean, if you ever met me in person, I could probably show the emotion on my face of how much it means to me that you're there listening to this, you support what I'm doing, this important project. The crowdfunding aspect of it is so important, and I'm so glad and honored to have you on the other side to listen to this. Tonight, when I post this on Patreon, it will be embedded in Patreon, and you can use the RSS feed to hopefully listen to it, or you can just press play right there in Patreon. But I'm also going to put the link to where this is on our webpage on the Hurricane Track Insider server. So you'll have a listing of everything. They are MP3 files. And so if you missed something from the past, maybe you're a new patron as you listen to this months from now or whatever, yes, there will be a link in tonight's posting on Patreon where all of the episodes live and will live, hopefully, for years to come. As always, I so much appreciate you tuning in. It's great, like I said, to have you there. Thank you so much. I am Mark Suddeth. You have been listening to another chapter of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. I'll be back again next week as we take a look back at the year 2001. Thanks. Have a great rest of your evening, or whenever it is that you're listening to this. It's evening for me as I cut this. I'll talk to you again with another story next week.